Hello, well, welcome to the second lecture for Thinking Out Loud. The lectures that this year are called Iconomy. The title has changed from the aesthetic supermarket. The lectures by Peter Zendi. Before we start the lectures, I'd like to read a message from Fred Nachbar, who is the director of Fordham University Press. As I mentioned on Monday, there were three people who really started the lectures. Besides myself, it was Alan Saunders from ABC Radio National and Helen Tartar from Fordham University Press. It was our idea, and we kind of put it together. My friend Maura Gatens pointed out, and I'm not thankful for that, I'm the only one standing. You know, unfortunately, 2 years ago, Alan died. He had an untimely death, and only about 2 months ago, Helen was killed in a car accident very unexpectedly. And Helen was one of the most important, if not the most important, editor in the theoretical humanities in the last 30 years or so. So her death was felt very strongly in the academic community. I was in a conference in New York just a couple of weeks after her death, and there was an amazing memorial dedicated to Helen as part of the conference. But in any case, Fred tried to send me a video, a little video that he made talking about Helen and about the Thinking Out Loud lectures, but for some reason the technology hasn't worked. So he transcribed that video message, and he asked me to read it instead, given that the technology failed. So I'll just read it before Peter Zendi starts. Okay. So hello, my name, well, not my name, but my name is Fred Nachbar, and I'm the director of Fordham University Press. As you all have heard, Helen Tartar was killed in a car accident on May 3rd. We're all deeply saddened by her sudden death and recognize that it has created a major loss for Fordham Press, Fordham University, and the humanities as a whole. The administration, board of directors of the press, and I remain strongly committed to Helen's editorial vision and have taken steps to ensure that we carry out her mission to publish outstanding scholarship in the humanities and across academic disciplines, including the Thinking Out Loud book series. Tom Lay, who worked closely with Helen over the past 8 years, has assumed the editorial responsibility for all her ongoing projects and will continue to work the work of reviewing manuscripts and seeking out new projects. I, Fred Nachbar, have started conducting a search for an editorial director. Recognizing that there is no replacing the unique editorial genius of Helen Tartar brought to Fordham, the board and I are soliciting the advice, support, and suggestions of serious editors, authors, and friends who worked with her over many years. Helen was very excited to be involved with the Thinking Out Loud series. In an early email sent to me conveying her enthusiasm, she wrote, so this is the first email that Helen wrote to Fred, talking to him about the lecture series. And I think when Helen spoke, she spoke in this very quiet voice. It's very hard for me, being Greek and kind of shouting all the time, you know, to really convey this voice. But she spoke in this very quiet voice. But, you know, it was almost, you know, even though it looked very, it sounded very timid, it was almost impossible to contradict. It carried a very strong authority. So imagine this email in that kind of almost whisper-like voice, but with absolute authority. If you actually read this email, I just read it a few minutes ago, if you actually listen to this email, it doesn't say so, but it demands that, you know, Fred goes with your idea. There is no way around it, okay? So she says, we have here an unexpected but quite nice spin-off from the publication of our first Modern Language Initiative book, which was my first book that was published by Fordham University Press. The opportunity to publish the results of an endowed lecture series that has been established at the University of Western Sydney, (UWS), organized by our Modern Language Initiative author, Dimitris Vardoulakis. These are often succinctly accessible accounts of the work of major thinkers, eminently suitable for course use. At times, they have also been major statements. I could amplify this list with lecture series books with which I've been associated over the years. On Fordham's list, comparable books to those envisioned are Judith Butler, Giving an Account of Oneself, which was given as the Adorno Lectures at Frankfurt and the Spinoza Lectures in Amsterdam, and Samuel Weber's Targets of Opportunity, given as an endowed lecture series at Princeton. Indeed, these two authors would be likely invitees to the new Thinking Out Loud series. The Fordham University Western Sydney collaboration would allow the books to emerge from the lecture series to an international circulation. So that was the first email whereby Helen introduced the lecture series and the book series to Fred. I want you, and here is Fred kind of, you know, talking himself after the email. I want to assure you that as interim member of the Thinking Out Loud Executive Committee, I remain committed to the series and to Helen's vision to it. Please do not hesitate to contact me if you have any questions or concerns. I look forward to working with you to build the series and its reputation now as the interim member in the future when a new editorial director is named. Thank you. So I read this message kind of in memory of Helen Tartar. And now taking a moment to reflect on Peter Zendi's lecture from Monday, a lecture that showed us how images circulate in an economy of exchanges, very much like money, you know, and showing us these wonderful clips from Bergson's Pickpocket and from The Sopranos. Reflecting for a moment on this wonderful lecture from Monday, I would like to invite Peter to continue with the second lecture here tonight. Peter.
So thank you very much, Dimitris. Since Monday, actually, we also had a short discussion with Dimitris about exchange and asymmetry, exchange and power, exchange maybe versus power. Let's say that this asymmetry that we could oppose to exchange, we could name it debt. And debt, in a way, will be my subject today for the second lecture, debt and images. So I would like to thank Dimitris again. I would like to thank also Chris Peterson, who responded on Monday to my lecture and who will respond also today. I keep thinking of what he said about the selfie on Monday. And in a way, when I will be talking today about self-consciousness and self-image, it will be a sort of echo to his question, though maybe not a direct answer, but certainly an echo. I would like also to thank Chris Fleming, who wrote a wonderful email to me today about Chris Fleming, who's a senior lecturer at the School of Humanities at UWS, who wrote a wonderful email to me today with fascinating details he shared with me about the Soprano episode that I showed last time. You remember the stickers on the fridge. He explained to me that they are basically slogans of Alcoholics Anonymous. So this would be the starting point of a whole line of thought that maybe I will come back to in our third lecture when I will try to talk about addiction, time, and images. So the title of this second lecture, the title of the whole series is, as Dimitris recalled, Iconomy. With an I. So the economy of images and the circulation. The title of the second lecture is No Exchange, which is actually an attempt to translate an untranslatable French expression that I had in mind, point d'échange, which would mean at the same time, point de is a sort of antiquated way of negating in French. So it would mean at the same time no exchange and also a point of exchange, so the very point of exchange. Anyway, the title would be in English, in plain and simple English, No Exchange or the Debt Image. And I would like to start by evoking the scenario of a possible filmic scene. A scene or a moment that I experienced so many times, and I guess that, like me, you must occasionally walk down the street at a sharp pace while crossing paths with pedestrians coming in the opposite direction who are also walking quickly. You are moving, they are moving, everything seems fluid, you are able to avoid each other, that is to say, allow each other to pass by without slowing down, taking the necessary step to one side, each one his or her own step in a direction symmetrical to the other. And it works, it flows. But from time to time, things get stuck, as you know. The fluidity gets congested. You step to one side, but in the wrong direction, the same direction as the person in front of you, and instead of being able to allow the other person to pass by, as you yourself do, you find yourself nose to nose with him or her, obstacle against obstacle. This crash up against one another with someone perfectly unknown is sometimes embarrassing. It is often funny, and it is all the funnier given that generally, when it happens, it immediately seems to want to repeat itself over and over again, like a jump cut, you know, a jump cut in movies, like a jump cut that would force the two characters of this banal sequence to find themselves constantly facing one another, stopping each other from continuing to walk in spite of all their efforts at goodwill or politeness. Now, what is happening in this scene, or this archy scene that we all know so well? It is apparently a question of cadence, a question of rhythm, of the conformity or adjustment of rhythms while walking. And we can imagine how this elementary combination of two gates that are trying to come to terms and compose in relation to one another, how it could be amplified and developed, just how complex it might become if not only a third pedestrian was added, but also a grid for measuring steps, a framework of marks where the steps have to fall. As a friend of mine, Christophe Kiem, recently reminded me, this is quite precisely what one can observe in a hilarious sequence from Jacques Tati's Mon Oncle, 1958. What happens in this sequence that I will show you is the following. Monsieur Harpel, one of the characters, drags another one, Pichard, his faithful subordinate, into a conversation whose rhythm comes from their stroll over the stone slabs of varying dimensions that are interspersed over the gravel in the garden of the hypermodern villa. The subject of their conversation, Tati himself, in the character, in his favorite character of Monsieur Hulot, the subject of the conversation silently joins up with the steps of the boss and his employee to lilt through a sort of three-step that tends to stall or freeze up with every step. And that ends when Monsieur Harpel, faced with Monsieur Hulot, walking backwards, cries out with a barely contained impatience, "Go ahead, old man," in French, "Passez, mon vieux." Now, let me show you this hilarious moment.
Venez, venez par ici.
C'est mon beau-frère.
Ah, très bien. Monsieur Pichard, mon collaborateur. Enchanté. Donc,
ce mot-là. Le beau-frère a besoin de se fixer, d'avoir dans l'existence un but. Enfin, vous comprenez. Parfaitement. Et pour lui, il serait temps de se loger, à se créer une situation. J'ai donc envisagé de le prendre avec nous. Allez-y. Ouais. Vous savez, Richard, la confiance, j'ai en vous.
Assez.
Passez, mon vieux. Please, go ahead, old man, says Monsieur Harpel. And it all ends up going ahead again, but the fluidity of circulation will, at every moment, will have threatened to fall into a kind of clog or standing still. In short, the archy scene I'm telling you about, and of which Tati proposes a kind of virtuoso variation, this archy scene is no doubt asking us to think through this punctuation or the punctuating gesture or point where the possibility of a passage is at stake. Passez, mon vieux, he says. In other words, the possibility of a change or of an exchange. I would like to try to draw closer to such a point of exchange, point d'échange, if there is any, and nothing is less certain. And in order to attempt to grasp it, I propose that we turn to other swapping scenes where the moment of exchange is visibly a question, the moment of exchange. We can find an equivalent for the ambulatory congestion in Mon Oncle, but this time transposed, so to speak, and raised to the level of hands, not feet, but hands, in other words, to the level of the exchange par excellence that the barter is. We find it in an equally hilarious sequence from The Party, the film directed by Blake Edwards in 1968. As you know, just to recall the plot elements, as you know, because of a mix-up, Hrundi V. Bakshi, played by Peter Sellers, finds himself at the party being given by the rich Hollywood producer Fred Clutterbuck, is his name in the film. And in the luxurious villa, Rundi activates playfully the buttons of a control panel, thus starting up the rotation of the table where the guests have placed their glasses, their silverware, their carafes, and their ashtrays. Before the sliding table disappears, bringing everything on it to the floor, Rundi just barely grabs the yellow telephone that was also getting ready to fall, and it starts ringing just at that moment, its sound mixing in with the crash of the broken glass. The camera alternates first between shots of Rundi answering, "Please remain connected to the telephone," he says to his unknown interlocutor, asking him in his inimitably comic and pompous way not to leave, to stay on the other end of the line, and shots of Clutterbuck, who watches him while holding in his hands everything he was able to save from the disaster, two glasses and an ashtray. This is when the craziest attempt at an exchange that I know of begins, with an insanity that is due to the very obviousness of its pure and simple impossibility. Let me show you that.
Four, six.
Now, what in effect happens? As you saw, Rundi is holding the phone in his left hand, and with his right hand, he's trying to place the receiver between Clutterbuck's cheek and shoulder. His hand gets stuck in the operation for a moment. "Could you let my hand go?" he diligently asks. Then, when he's able to wrest it free, he catches two glasses between his fingers while the receiver's cord starts to get tangled around the ashtray and the arms of the two exchangers, who are both increasingly incapable to see through on the permutation they are struggling toward. It's a real miracle, actually, that Clutterbuck can end up answering the phone call, that he can finally have what in French is commonly called a telephonic exchange, échange téléphonique. For while the vocabulary of the exchange is omnipresent in the scraps of dialogue emitted by the two extremely preoccupied and tangled up men, they say, "hold," "take," "let go." They are constantly, you know, using words from the vocabulary of exchange. Well, their words are immediately contradicted by the inextricable interlacing of things that seems to block any possible swapping circulation. But in particular, what is highlighted by their infinite contortions is both the necessity and impossibility of reciprocity in exchange. Here, what in effect makes us laugh is that instead of all of a sudden and simultaneously exchanging the telephone and the glasses, Rundi and Clutterbuck have to go through a whole series of relays, displacements, and temporizations whose effect is that the exchange, properly speaking, does not take place. Or rather, and more precisely, that the moment of exchange, its punctual instant, is impossible to find. It is literally impossible to grasp. It doesn't allow itself to be taken nor kept, for it is diluted. It crumbles like dust in a dissemination of micro-exchanges that we might describe, to stay in the economic register, we might describe them as interim loans or security deposits. Basically, that's what happens here. Now, even more than burlesque and all its variants, there is one cinematic genre, or what I would call instead maybe a generic scene, whose stakes, whose sole and unique stakes, seem to be the staging of perfect reciprocity and simultaneity of exchange. I am speaking of the duel in the Western, of that challenge to death that, as Alfred Hitchcock has magnificently shown, presupposes the impossible condition of strict contemporaneity and pure equivalence. In the third episode of the first season of the series Alfred Hitchcock Presents, one finds something like the generic formula of the duel as an impossible exchange. The episode, called Triggers in Leash, and broadcast on October 16, 1955, the episode consists in a duel that never takes place and that, nonetheless, is constantly on the point of happening. The two adversaries are two cowboys, Del Delaney and Red Hillman. And the reason for their conflict, as they explain to Maggie, who tends a little shack that serves as a country inn, the reason for their conflict is a poker match that had brought them together the night before. Del claims he quit the game because Red, who was too drunk to play seriously, would have been cleaned out, while Red accuses Del of having left the game after having gained the advantage and without leaving him a chance to take his revenge. Thus, without allowing him to get even, in other words, to make his way back to equality or equivalence. Maggie, tries to reason with them, but in vain, and this is why, giving up, she throws out the fateful question to them. Which one is going to be the killer? Because the first one to draw, she promises them, will be denounced as a murderer, so that he can be judged and hanged. Therefore, each one, with the expectation that the other will draw first, and in the hopes of being faster, they resign themselves to waiting. They settle in to the wait, and both sit down at a table, while Maggie serves them something to eat. She's even the one who cuts their ham for them, for they both must be equally, they must equally keep their two hands visible on the table, so they can't cut the ham. In short, time goes by, and the duel, properly speaking, still doesn't take place, though it doesn't stop being imminent. It is always imminent and never takes place, as you will see, until the moment when Red gets an idea. They will wait to draw until the hand of the clock hits exactly noon and the cuckoo bird comes out. Let's begin even, Red proposes. Let's begin even. So let's start, basically, he says, let's start in equality or in equivalence. In other words, let's wait for the signal to launch the exchange of fire exactly at the same time, right, in perfect simultaneity, so that neither the one nor the other can be accused of murder. I will show you a first sequence from the episode.
We'll both stand, and then we'll agree that neither of us will draw until that cuckoo bird sticks its neck out of the clock. But when it does, we both hit leather.
Yeah, that's crazy.
What do you say, Doug? Makes sense. Nobody draw it till the birdie cries.
Oh, right. Finish your meal. It should take some time to think.
Sure, I'll take off the coat. And then you'll draw. No, thank you very much. Which is so flabby.
Etc. As you saw, the camera alternates not only between the shots of Red, Del, and Maggie, but it also, and in particular, shows the clock that is placed exactly halfway between the two adversaries, so much so that its pendulum, in its oscillatory movement, seems literally to describe the alternation, the movement from the one to the other and return. The alternation on its way to being condensed in an immediate reciprocity in the punctual or stigmatic instant of the dualistic exchange. The exact hour draws near, the tension mounts and becomes almost intolerable. Maggie asks the duelers, stiffened into their defined posture, to be allowed just to take the crucifix laid on the shelf next to the clock. And we then see close-ups on their eyes, on the two antagonist gazes, the stakes of the duel merging with the cinematic figure of shot and countershot. It is at this point that what Maggie interprets as a little miracle takes place. The tick-tock stops and time remains suspended, as if the camera's point of view had to stay stuck at the exact intersection between one gaze and the other, at the precise point where the two gazes meet. Let me show you that.
What's taking so long? Maggie,
to fall on your knees, Rachel. Fall down and beg forgiveness. Look at that clock. It stopped.
Now, in this stopped instant, the duel proves to be impossible. It will always be deferred. In the end, it won't take place. But this is an infinite procrastination and an impossibility in which the dual's most proper possibility is also lodged, that of perfect simultaneity and reciprocity, which can only happen by not happening, by remaining suspended in this expectation. If time had not stopped, if they had both drawn at the same time, at the precise moment when the cuckoo had popped out its head, in short, if the duel had happened within and according to the perfect equality, in and according to what we might call the equiduality that it seems to demand, it would have immediately fallen into inequivalence, into the fateful asymmetry leading the one, Red or Del, to become the assassin of the other, Del or Red. In sum, the dualistic exchange transformed into murder would have become the opposite of the exchange it should be. In this impossible duel, it is hard not to see something like the staging of the famous, of the all-too-famous dialectic of master and slave, of lordship and bondage, Herrschaft und Knechtschaft, from the Phenomenology of the Spirit, as if Hegel, rather than Richard Carr or Alan Vaughan Elston, whose names appear in the credits, as if Hegel were the scene's hidden screenplay writer. For at stake in this all-too-famous Hegelian passage, on which so many interpretations and commentaries have accumulated that I barely dare open it again to reread it, at stake is precisely, I believe, the impossible mutuality of exchange in the one's recognition by the other. In the Phenomenology of the Spirit, like in the dual scene in general, there are two self-consciousnesses, Selbstbewusstseine, that, as we know, prove themselves and each other through a life and death struggle. Hegel's words. Sie sich selbst und einander durch den Kampf auf Leben und Tod bewähren. In German. Now, in the pages preceding this moment in the Phenomenology of the Spirit, this struggle to death for recognition and self-certainty is configured as an exchange. In effect, after having posited the fact that self-consciousness is a return to self from otherness or from being other, Anderssein, Hegel shows that this alterity must itself has the structure of self-consciousness. I quote, self-consciousness achieves its satisfaction only in another self-consciousness. End of quote. And it is only on the basis of that other that self-consciousness, I quote, receives back its own self, receives back its own self. Hegel's German expression, erhält sich selbst zurück, has been interestingly translated in French by a very famous translator and commentator, Jean Hippolyte, as se recouvre elle-même, as if it was a matter of debt collection, of collecting oneself as one collects a debt, se recouvrir soi-même. Through the other, self-consciousness again becomes equal to itself. Es wird sich wieder gleich. It recovers or grabs back its self-equivalence. But, as we know, over the course of this process of reappropriation of self from the other and through the other also receives itself or wins itself back. It, too, recuperates itself as that self it then equally becomes. The self-consciousness, writes Hegel, quote, also gives the other self-consciousness back again to itself. Gibt es das andere Selbstbewusstsein ihm wieder zurück. In other words, it returns it equally, ebenso, says Hegel, it returns it equally to itself. Now, several paragraphs further on, Hegel notes that in this reciprocal moment of the exchange in recognition between two self-consciousnesses, I quote, we see repeated the process which presented itself as the play of forces. End of quote. Without wanting or being able to resume the passage Hegel is alluding to here, it comes from the previous chapter of the Phenomenology of the Spirit, a chapter called Force and Understanding. We must nevertheless remember that at stake was change or alternation, Wechsel in German, change or alternation qualified as absolute or pure. But when Hegel indicates that we are witnessing the repetition of the same process of change or alternation, we are witnessing its repetition between two self-consciousnesses, this time it is certainly a matter of exchange. The German word is Austauschung, and we are not at all that far away from a swap or a barter, Tausch, Austauschung. This is why Hegel can conclude, and I quote, each is for the other the middle term through which each mediates itself with itself and unites with itself. And he adds, they recognize themselves as mutually recognizing one another. Right? They recognize themselves as mutually recognizing one another. Sie anerkennen sich als gegenseitig sich anerkennend. End of quote. Now, if we could punctuate the dialectical phrase of the exchange of mutual recognition right here, if we could stop it before, in the very next paragraph, it falls into what Hegel calls the Ungleichheit among exchangers, a word that could be translated as inequality or non-parity. So if we could stop it here, punctuate it here, we would grasp the exact instant, the precise moment of exchange as such. We would produce its still or snapshot, so to speak, as if the flash of a photograph capturing the one and the other, the one as the other, and perhaps even the one from the point of view of the other, as if the flash of this photograph doubled the dual's shot in order to immobilize it, to nab it and pin it down here and now, to freeze it as it is. As a matter of fact, the shot fired is also, in English, the photo taken. What in photography is called a snapshot. That shot can be understood both as gunshot and snapshot is something Susan Sontag noted in her own way in her essay on photography. Comparing the modern camera to a ray gun, she saw in it a sublimation of the gun. To photograph someone, she wrote, is a sublimated murder, or hunting for that matter. I quote her, one situation where people are switching from bullets to film is the photographic safari that is replacing the gun safari. Instead of looking through a telescopic sight to aim a rifle, they look through a viewfinder to frame a picture. End of quote. Now, it is this double or triple sense of shot, a gunshot and a photographic or cinematographic view, it is this double or triple sense that we can also recognize, if we indeed lend an ear to it, in the title of John Ford's 1962 film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Of course, the man who shot him with a gun, but also the man who filmed Liberty Valance, the film whose narrative is precisely that of a shot that doubles another, that substitutes itself for another, or hides behind another, since the true mortal gunshot is not the one we had thought. I'll be returning to this later. Shot, then, both as the shot of a gun and of a camera. It is this instantaneous doubling that is staged in the false final duel of Il mio nome è nessuno, My Name is Nobody, a parodic Western produced and in part directed by Sergio Leone in 1973 with Tonino Valeri. In the duel sequence that I will show you, Leone, who has never hidden his admiration for Ford and who explicitly situates himself in the Fordian line or tradition, proposes a parodic remake, so to speak, of the double shot in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance that we will see later. So first the parody, then the original. While the two heroes of My Name is Nobody, one being called as a character Jack Beauregard, and what a name, right? Jack Beauregard, played by Henry Fonda. The other one being Nobody, what a name also, played by Terence Hill. So while the two heroes, Jack Beauregard and Nobody, are face to face in a street in New Orleans, a photographer is getting ready to snap this historic settling of scores, over the course of which the death of a legend, Jack Beauregard, will mark the consecration in legend of the one who was nobody. The result of the duel is anxiously awaited amid general silence, and this waiting is deferred by the timid requests from the photographer, who proves unable to frame the scene correctly. Nobody consents to moving a bit in order to afford a nice shot, in order to indeed be immortalized at the very moment he is exposed to death. And suddenly there is the deflagration, a double explosion, first that of the gunshot, then, as if in a long deferred echo, that of the photographic flash while Jack Beauregard collapses. Now, I leave this image in the background. You will see why. The percussive punctuation of the shot is thus repeated in that of the photograph being taken, in the punctual snapshot, in the blink that closes back up to capture an image after the fact. And everything thus happens as if this imaging capture presupposed dissymmetry, Ungleichheit, as its condition of possibility, in other words, the deferral or gap that cannot but intrude in the moment of the exchange of gunshots, an exchange that should nonetheless have been the instant of simultaneity and perfect reciprocity. But, so the image, the capturing of the image comes later. Right? But let us make the hypothesis that the photographer has been able to take the photo he wanted to take. That is, the photo of the very instant of the exchange, rather than its deferred or after-the-fact effects. Let's make the hypothesis. What would this image have looked like? This snapshot of which we see nothing, the one whose possibility we only glimpse through the images that are showed to us in reverse, appearing upside down in the camera's lens. Well, the photo we will never see would be the visual equivalent of the epitaph we then read. Jack Beauregard, 1848-1899, nobody was faster on the draw. How might we translate this abyssal funereal description that can be read in two exactly opposed ways, as if it itself were a dual in signification. First, in effect, we can indeed understand it as marking nobody's victory, the victory of nobody in person, if I dare say so. Nobody was faster on the draw. Nobody himself will have been faster to draw than was Beauregard, faster than he and outpacing him for as long as a glance, quite precisely, for as long as a shot. But, secondly, we can also read this phrase as a negation, as its own negation. Nobody, in the end, absolutely no one, will have been faster than Beauregard. Between the two, there is, in English, a different way of accenting or punctuating the phrase, which therefore contains the two possibilities within it, in a strictly interchangeable way, austauschbar, we could say in Hegel's language. It contains the two possible readings within it, simultaneously oscillating from the one to the other, with the one contradicting the other, and vice versa, in a kind of suspended dialectic or a dialectic at a standstill. The photo whose possibility we glimpse between the reversed images, the snapshot of the photographer, the snapshot he was preparing to take, but he ends up taking only in the afterwards, right? So that image would no doubt have had, it should have had, the very appearance of that phrase. On the one hand, that image should have been the image of exchange itself, condensed into a snapshot of pure reciprocity. But, on the other hand, precisely because it would have shown exchange as such, it should have itself been what I will call an exchange image, an image that would immediately exchange itself for its own opposite. It should have, for example, shown both nobody's gaze and Beauregard's symmetrical gaze, regard in French. It should have shown them, as we say in French, en regard, in other words, face to face. In short, as an image, it should have occupied, in the cinematic figure of the shot-hyphen-countershot, the exact place of the hyphen. But we could also write the formula of the exchange image by replacing this hyphen by a colon with a sign of equivalence or reciprocal permutability that would quite precisely inscribe the place of the exchange image at the limit, at the very point of the edit, that would intersect and interchange the two halves of a sightline between the eyes of the one and the eyes of the other. So, imagine two pair of eyes and the sign of equivalence par excellence, which would be the colon, right? This would be the formula of our scene or archi-scene of the duel. We could formulate the graph for the exchange image as this graph, with the two points of the colon exchanging two eyes against two eyes, punctuating one another in the stigmatic punctuality of an instantaneous reciprocity. This would be, in sum, the stakes of the exchange image, of that image that there is not, but that the dual is constantly presupposing or striving towards. Now, if there is no such image, if there is no exchange image, this is at bottom for a very simple reason, whose consequences are nonetheless unfathomable, i.e. there is no exchange, there is only credit or debt. To state it otherwise, and in a way that is no doubt extremely formalized, as soon as time is introduced into the exchange, as soon as exchange takes time, which it always does, it becomes impossible to distinguish rigorously between exchange and credit or debt. For an exchange that is not simultaneous would place one of the two exchangers in the position of a debtor and the other in the position of a creditor, if only for a while, and for however brief a while it may be. Here I cannot undertake the philosophical genealogy of such a thought, which would make debt the foundation of exchange. One would have to go back at least as far as Nietzsche and the Genealogy of Morals, published in 1887, but also already to certain fragments by Nietzsche on equity, published in 1880 in The Traveller and His Shadow. What interests me are the stakes of a philosophy of debt in terms of the economy of the image, in terms of what I'm calling the iconomy of the visible. In order to attempt to sketch these stakes out, allow me now to turn to that other Western I have already alluded to, the man who shot Liberty Valance, whose protagonist, you might recall, is named Ransom, and whose title bears within it the question of value and valence. The narrative structure of the film works through a flashback. The senator Ransom Stoddard, James Stewart, nicknamed Rance in the film, the senator returns with his wife, Haley, to the little city of Shinbone in order to attend the funeral of Tom Doniphan, John Wayne. Over the course of an interview in the local paper, he recounts how, several decades earlier, he was riding on board of a stagecoach when it was attacked by a gang of robbers led by the outlaw Liberty Valance, Lee Marvin. Beaten almost to the point of death, Ransom was given assistance by Doniphan and then cared for by a restaurant owner and his wife. Later on, one night, while Ransom is serving at his protector's restaurant, Valance attempts to humiliate him, and Doniphan takes his defense. And from then on, an undeclared war is brewing between the future senator and the outlaw. It doesn't take long for the war to break out. When Ransom is elected as a representative to territorial convention, Valance challenges him into a duel. Now, it is this duel, yet another one, that must hold our attention. Because, rather than being a challenge worthy of that name, here it is actually a matter of an anti-duel, a non-duel that, far from being a quest for recognition among equals in a struggle to death, seems to be more of a methodic exercise in humiliation of the one by the other. Valance, in effect, first wounds Ransom in the arm. He then allows him to pick his weapon back up and this time promises to put the next bullet right between the eyes. And this is when the coup de théâtre takes place, the coup de théâtre that dictates the film's title. Although no one is expecting it, Ransom, though he's known as the epitome of the bad shooter, more awkward than anyone else with arms, with firearms, with one well-placed shot becomes the man who shot Liberty Valance. He becomes the hero. Now, at stake in this anti-duel, as is the case for the supposedly authentic duels that we previously watched, is once again the exchange of gazes, at least as much as the exchange of gunshots. But this time, the apparent visual reciprocity of the shot-countershot has given way to the dissymmetry between shadow and light, between retreat and visibility. Come closer where I can see you, Liberty is obliged to tell Ransom, get out of that shadow, dude. Inequality, the Ungleichheit Hegel speaks of, is marked out everywhere, from the imparity of the two dualists to the left-right inequivalence that jumps to our attention when Ransom, picking up his weapon with the only arm that has remained well and able, hears Liberty tell him, you've got two hands, pick it up. Yet, as we will learn a bit later on, the exchange, in a way, will have been perfect. There will indeed have been a perfect instantaneous substitution of one shot of fire by another, but a hidden one. Now, an exchange that remains hidden without the awareness of the ones swapping is no doubt not an exchange worthy of the name. What is missing is the condition of mutuality, symmetry, and contemporaneity of recognition, as well as reciprocity of visibility. What is this hidden exchange? What happened? After having thus become the man who killed Liberty Valance, Ransom goes to the convention to present his candidacy for the election of the members of Congress. And there he's told that it would be unfair to elect a man merely because he has killed another. So his reputation becomes a problem. And in a final act of sacrificial generosity, Doniphan then admits to him that he was the veritable shooter of the duel, a duel thus expanded into a secret triangulation, that he, Doniphan, shot at the same time as Ransom, simultaneously, exchanging, but from the shadows that hid him, one bullet and one writer of wrongs for another in an absolute coincidence. A second flashback then starts, a flashback within the general flashback of the story, where the camera draws close to Doniphan's eyes. The smoke from his cigarette serves as a wipe, you will see, that leads us back toward the repetition of the dual scene, but this time filmed from another point of view. Through the perfect yet secret exchange that underpins it, this duel that will never have been one, this anti-duel, becomes, however we understand it, an image of infinite debt and absolute dissymmetry. The one, Ransom, is infinitely indebted to the death of the other, Liberty, for what becomes his glory, his reputation, but he is also, and above all, in debt to the other, to Doniphan, who embodies a kind of intermediate loan, an intermediary and supplementary credit that allows him to contract the main debt. The perfect exchange thus proves itself to shelter an abyssal and perfectly asymmetrical debt in its heart. It is even a debt that, at the limit, was contracted unknown to the debtor. It hides a kind of ransom that Ransom bears is inscribed into his name. While Liberty, at bottom, died free, he will have been as good as his liberty, but of a valence, so to speak, that is also absolutely dissymmetrical, since it is precisely that of death. After all, as Hegel says, life itself is as essential to self-consciousness as its negation in the liberty that chooses death. Through the network of debts that weave through the film and in the gap, however minimal or instantaneous, that every time opens all these debtors' accounts, the man who shot Liberty Valance shows us that the image takes time. Not only in the sense that shooting on a set is long and demands weeks, months, even years. But also and above all, because the images that will have been taken and shot in this way are always awaiting other ones that will come to give their value back to them. We could say that there is no image. There is no image in the sense that there is always more than one image. An image, and Bresson, we saw that the other day, an image, and Bresson formulated this better than anyone else, an image only has value in relation to others, which comes down to saying not only that it can be an image of the dead, not only that it can represent and allow the indebtedness of one character or another to be seen, Ransom in relation to Doniphan, for example, but also that an image is always a debt image, indebted as it is in relation to other images. There is no exchange image, I was saying, in a general economy of which the duel constitutes a kind of primal scene. This is what we no doubt need to think all the way through. In the swapping circulation of images that structures us and takes us away more than ever before today, there are only debt images or credit images, no exchange image. Thank you very much.